Welcome to the Commonwealth Club. I'm George Hammond, Chair of the Humanities Forum. It's my great pleasure to welcome our audience here live in San Francisco and our radio and online audiences. And it's also my pleasure to introduce the speakers tonight, speaking about their book, The West Without Water, perfect timing after this summer. And it's Dr. Lynn Ingram, professor at UC Berkeley, and Dr. Francis Malman Rome, senior environmental planner at Caltrans, and they've worked together on the research. It's a very interesting period, historical research of what the water situation has been like in California for millennia. Well, thank you very much for coming.
Thank you so much for being here, and thank you for the invitation from the Commonwealth Club. So today we'll be talking about California's climate history, primarily the history we have of geologic history of the droughts and floods in California. And I should say my co-author, Dr. Malman Rome, and I will be trading off during the talk, so a few times. So why do we study past climate? Why are we interested in that? And what are some of the questions that we're interested in? So how much we're concerned about how much the climate varies naturally, and we can get that by looking at the geologic past. How frequent and severe were past droughts, fires, and floods? How did they impact past human societies? And how did past warming impact water resources? So these are some of the questions we'll be talking about tonight. Okay, so I'll start with, of course, our current situation, which I'm sure most of you are aware. This is the drought monitor from August 21st, and shows that, so the map of California showing the various shades representing the severity of the drought. So we have moved into a phase of 80% of California being in severe or exceptional drought. And this is I'm going to walk over to the screen for this, a graph showing the cumulative precipitation plotted on this axis versus a month. So here's October 1st, 2013. Going to December, here's May, and October 1st, 2014. And so what this shows, it has various years plotted here. So just for comparison, here's the wettest year on record, 1982-83, which was an El Nino year. And so you can see how extremely wet. And by the way, this is for the northern, the Sacramento watershed. Then we have the lower years here. So this one is actually 1976-77, and here's 1923-24. So these were the driest years. The blue line here is showing this year, and what you can see is that we started the year sort of being on track with the driest years, but then we had those storms in February, March, that kind of brought us up here to, we're currently around 60% of average for Northern California. And if we think about, maybe move back about 12 years in time, so here's 2002 and here's 2014. So these are the average California runoff as percentage of May 1st average. And the red is showing the drought years, so less than average. And the blue is showing more than average, greater than average. So you can see that over the last 12 years, 10 of these years were below average. So, this is obviously a concern in the sense that it seems that we have many more less than average precipitation years in the recent decade. And so, of course, our water supply has been impacted, and I'm sure most of you have seen these photos online. Or Shasta, our largest reservoir, is down to maybe 50%, and Folsom Lake on the American River. So all of the reservoirs are really down to maybe 40 to 50% at this point. And we've also seen an unusually long fire season, and this Yosemite Rim fire was relatively early in the season last August. It was a very hot fire, very severe fire, but we've had, you know, recent fires with a much greater than average number of fires this year as well. And so now I'd like to move back a little bit more in time in terms of looking at the average rainfall. So this is 1870 up to 2010, and plotted the average rainfall for all of California. And so what one of the first things you can really see is how extremely variable our climate is, really. You know, we have extremely dry years. Here's 1976-77, which was the single driest year over the period. And here's that Dust Bowl 6-year drought there. And so the question is, you know, what happened? What are the longer-term cycles? You can kind of see a decadal cycle if you squint and if we average this data. So there's different modes of variability. There's variability created by things like El Nino, and then we have a more decadal variability in climate. But if we step even further back, we're going to look at some of the other climate variability that we can see. And the other thing I should point out, I pointed out that we have these extremely dry years, also very wet years. So we have an extremely variable climate. And this is just a few photos, Dorothea Lange-type photos of the Dust Bowl, which people don't tend to think of California as having been in drought, but it was a severe drought in California at that time as well. And we got bailed out by farmers starting to pump groundwater in the Central Valley. So the invention of the pump and being able to access more groundwater sort of bailed out agriculture and has continued, you know, we're continuing to do that today. And then on the other side of the spectrum, we've had some very wet years and big floods. So this is 1938, quite a wet year. This is the Santa Ana River in Orange County. And this is 1955, it was a big flood. And this is showing the San Lorenzo River in Santa Cruz. And then other years that were wet were 1969, 1983, 1997, and 2006. And so in order to step back further than our instrumental records, we have to look back in the natural archives. So the geologic record and also the biological record. This is showing tree rings. And these trees that can live for centuries or millennia have a record of climate in the thicknesses of their annual rings. And so dendrochronologists can study this. This is one of the main tools for at least going back about maybe 1 to 2,000 years of looking at past climate change. And so you can see, for example, here, these rings are very narrow, and this was the 16th century mega drought. So actually the very driest year in the last 500 years was in 1580 AD here. So that was even drier than 1976-77. And so now Francis will start discussing what the records have been telling us about California's past history.
Thanks, Lynn. Just real quickly before I get going, I have to give the necessary disclaimer that while my current title and job is at Caltrans, I'm an environmental planner, biologist there. This work has nothing to do with Caltrans, and reflects the work Lynn and I did when I was a postdoc and a graduate student for her at UC Berkeley. So that out of the way, they were happy years for me, and Lynn has kindly let me continue on with her. We're going to look a bit, I'm going to talk a bit about the research we did, some of the archives we looked at, and I'm going to talk about how we get some of these archives, how we look at them, and then what they're showing. And I'll try not to spend too much time on methodology, because that can be a little bit tedious. Did I go the wrong way? Yes. Sorry about that. So just looking at the history, the piece of history we're looking at. So even Fox Television will tell you that climate fluctuates. There's climate change that's already happened. And that's true. I mean, for the last several million years, we've gone in and out of ice ages or glacial periods. 20,000 years ago, we were in the depths of a glacial maximum, and then came out of that about 12,000 to 10,000 years ago. We entered into the current interglacial period of warmth, known as the Holocene, if you talk to geologists. So our research primarily focuses on the last 10,000 years. And here's a couple of highlights. The Little Ice Age, which I'm sure you guys are familiar with, back in the 14th, 1700s. And then the medieval warm period, which is a period we'll be talking about a fair amount during this talk. And that occurred about 1,000 years ago. Let's see if I push the right button this time. Yes. So the records we drew from for our research, there's a lot of data out there being generated, being collected. We certainly haven't collected all of it. We've been reviewing a huge amount of work done looking at tree ring studies, like Lynn showed you this slab of a tree ring. All those red and blue dots represent tree ring studies. And each of those tree ring studies actually represents many, many, many trees that were cored, but no trees were sacrificed for that research, just little pieces of like a pencil. So they survived. Other studies that we looked at included lake sediment studies, and those are the squares that you see. There are several places, lakes, mountain lakes in particular, where people collected sediments. And then those sediments, because they're lake beds, they settle in a sequential fashion. The top sediments are the most recent. The deeper you go, the older you get. And so there's a lot of history in those sediments. Lynn and I, our research focused on sediment cores from the San Francisco Bay estuary. And that's what I'm going to talk a little bit more about right now. And the reason we love the San Francisco Bay estuary is in part because San Francisco is here, and it's one of the best places to live in the country. But as a researcher, it's also a fabulous place because the Bay estuary drains 40% of the area of California. So that most rain that falls on our state eventually makes its way to the San Francisco Bay Estuary and then out the Golden Gate, which makes it a really good, if you want to find a way of looking back in time, you figure out how much water was flowing through the Delta back through time. What makes it easy to look at that is the San Francisco Bay Estuary is an estuary, which means it's a mixing zone of salt water coming in from the Pacific Ocean and fresh water coming in from all those creeks, rivers, all that watershed that was shown in the last slide. So what we did was found locations throughout the bay that would give us a record of changes in salinity in the bay, and that would reflect this relationship between fresh water coming in. Basically, there has been global sea level rise over the last 2,000 years of records, or 10,000 years even, but we can back that out, and then the difference that we see has to do with climate change or fluctuations in climate. So this shows folks like us going out there and collecting sediment cores from the bay itself, and a lot of Lynn's research came from the San Francisco Bay, sites within the bay, going out on these big boats, these ocean drilling, well, this is actually small compared to some of them, but going out with these big drills that drill down into the bay sediments and collect cores that, I don't know how easy it is for you to see it, but here's a core right there that's just been extruded from one of those drills. And they go for, you know, quite a number of meters down. And you can see it's kind of all the same color, right? So it's not quite so easy to back out what happened in the past. We don't have lots of very obvious laminations. Some records do, but not from the bay. There we have to look at what we call environmental proxies. In other words, things that are in that mud that we can study and learn from. And basically we're looking at the chemistry of some of these sediments. In particular, there are a lot of little organisms that live in the bay. This is an example of one blown up many, many times. It's a foram. They're about the size of a pinhead. And their shell is a calcium carbonate shell. And to make a long story short, the calcium carbonate in that shell can be used to reflect. It adopts the salinity signal of the bay water that little creature was swimming in during its life. So sort of you are what you swim in. In addition, you can date these cores with carbon-14 dating. And then we take these cores. You can see this one represents 1,600 centimeters. Well, actually, the top 200 were not included in the diagram, but from about 200 down to 1,600 centimeters of sediments were analyzed for salinity change. And you can see at the top, we show salinity. Moving to the right of the chart is, at least my right, is that your left, excuse me, lower salinity, higher salinity. And then on this other axis, the vertical axis there, we show dates. And then just the key take-home message is there is variability in salinity recorded in the bay. And in particular, you can see this trend that started about 1,000 years ago and lasted quite a while of a real increase, dramatic increase in salinity in the bay. And that corresponds to that medieval warm period that I showed in that slide where I said, oh, look, we're going to talk a lot about the medieval warm period. And then continuing on with where we studied and a bit about methodology. So next to the wonderful estuary are wonderful tidal marshes. And the marshes form a salinity gradient that goes along with the estuary itself. So the closer we are to the delta where all the fresh water is coming in, the marshes tend to be fresher. Closer we are to the Pacific Ocean, where most of the marine influence is coming in, the saltier. So we went out to these tidal marshes and we collected sediment cores, shorter than the ones you can get from the bay. But they reflect changes in the vegetation that was on the surface. So we could look at the sediments, focusing mainly on the organic sediments, and then say, what were the plants that were growing on the surface? And that tells us something about salinity. If we see a lot of this stuff, which is pickleweed over there in that corner, lots of pickleweed means probably it's pretty salty. We see lots of tules in the sediments, evidence of tules. We know it was getting fresher. Anyway, combining all these different records from what we can get out of the marsh sediments, we see a similar pattern where about 1,000 years ago, bracketing about 1,000 years ago, in this one it shows from about 750 to almost 1750, there was a dry period in our record reflected in the marsh sediments. So it complements pretty well the data that Lynn was getting from the bay estuary itself. So Lynn's going to come up and talk about some of those other studies that we looked at, mainly doing literature survey.
Okay, so we wanted to compare our what we were finding in San Francisco Bay with other records of climate change from California and the Southwest. And so just to remind you again, so here's San Francisco Bay, and we looked at, it's not shown on here, but Lake Tahoe, were two places that we compared in terms of these paleoclimate records. And so here's Mono Lake in the Eastern Sierra. And Scott Stein, who got his PhD at UC Berkeley in geography, did a study showing past lake levels. This is a closed basin, and so when it's wetter, the lake grows larger, and when it's drier, you have more evaporation, the lake shrinks. And so he could look at the sediments and reconstruct the size of the lake. And so this is his reconstruction here. This is age and thousands of years ago, and this is going back to 2000. Here's 1,000 year 2000. And this is the lake level here with elevation larger, so wetter to the left, drier to the right. And so you can see that the lake fluctuated pretty regularly. There's actually a 200-year cycle of fluctuation in the lake. And then this medieval period that Frankie was just talking about, it was pretty uniformly a small lake. So it was. There's further evidence that it was dry during that medieval period. And then there was a high stand 3,800 years ago. So it was very wet during that time. And then more evidence for this medieval drought, or mega drought, now we're calling it, comes from these tree stumps that, again, Scott Stein had was out in the Sierras, and he observed these stumps of trees in bodies of water, or regions that are now covered by water. So this is, for example, is Tenaya Lake in Yosemite, and you can see these little tree stumps sticking up above the surface, and these are rooted tree stumps in the lake. And then this is the Walker River in Eastern Sierra. But he found them throughout the Sierra, and he radiocarbon dated the outer bark, and then he counted the rings to see how long these trees. So in other words, these were places that had completely dried out for these trees to become established. They can't grow, obviously, in wet areas like this. And so the radiocarbon dates actually came out with two generations of two large droughts, 900 to 1100 AD and 1200 to 1350 AD, and that's during the medieval. So these are called the medieval mega droughts that he found in the 90s. And then some further evidence for drought, or what would be the consequence of these mega droughts, comes from the giant sequoias in Yosemite National Park, and also Sequoia National Park. Tom Swetnam, who's at the Tree Ring Lab in Tucson, Arizona, at the University of Arizona, studied fire scars in the trunks of these giant sequoia. So the trees will actually survive large fires, but it will, you'll see a scar, and so you can actually date them and count the frequency of these scars. And what he found was there was an increased frequency of fires during this medieval mega drought. And so if we move now to the Four Corners region, of course there's a lot of research we're not gonna be discussing from here, but they also have evidence for this mega drought. And some of the archaeological evidence shows that there was a collapse in the Anasazi populations during that time, toward the end of that drought. And so these are, for example, in central Arizona, throughout Arizona, some of the populations there, the Sanagua and Hohokam populations, and this is Mesa Verde in Colorado. There's also other locations, lots of locations where these sites were abandoned. And the skeletal evidence shows increased malnutrition and conflict among people. So one, at least least one hypothesis is that this was due to this mega drought. And we also have evidence, archaeological evidence in California. This is actually from the Santa Barbara Channel Islands, where you have these shell mounds. And we also have shell mounds, over 400 shell mounds have been mapped around San Francisco Bay. And these mounds date back to 5,000 to 6,000 years ago and older in the Channel Islands. And so there's skeletal remains in these shell mounds. And they show evidence of conflict and violence in terms of damage done to the skeletal remains, infant mortality, malnutrition, starvation. And it also looked like these sites were abandoned as people probably migrated or went in search for resources over larger areas during this mega drought. And then I just want to point out quickly, I've just been talking about this medieval period here, but if we step back a little bit to the middle part of the Holocene from 6,000 to 4,700 years ago, that was the climactic optimum where the globe was warmer during that time as well. And what we see in California is there was also extended drought during that globally warm period. So this is actually similar to Scott Stein's tree stumps. Trees have been discovered in Lake Tahoe, and actually originally by a UC Berkeley civil engineering professor who noticed them during the Dust Bowl drought. So I think it was in 1934, he was up at Lake Tahoe and he saw above the lake these tree stumps. And back then, there was not radiocarbon dating, so he couldn't date them. He didn't know how old they were, but he hypothesized that those trees, you know, suggested that the climate was a lot drier at some time in the past. And it was later an archaeologist, Susan Lindstrom, who came back, and she actually came back with scuba gear, and she sampled a lot of these trees and then radiocarbon dated them. And showed that they were, they dated to about 6,000 to 4,700 years ago. So in a very extended period of dry, very dry conditions during that time. And also there was migration. There's evidence that the people at that time, the native populations, migrated from the Great Basin and the interior deserts to the coast because of this drought. They were just searching for resources. Okay, so we want to switch gears a little bit because even though, of course, we're mainly concerned about droughts at this time, floods, and we'll describe what we mean by mega floods in California, are also, the other side of climate and something that we're also worried about. So.
People aren't getting dizzy. we kind of look alike, though. So we're going to talk about the other side of the coin, the climate coin, that our research showed. And back in the late 90s, actually, this kind of research was pretty interesting because there was that 97, I believe it was. Was that the really wet year? Yeah, so people were very worried about flooding. You know, all of California is going to flood. So California has an extreme climate. And we tend to go between extreme drought and extreme wet years. So just looking, again, I'm just going to give you a little brief history. Going back only to the late 1800s, we see some peaks in this record where we have precipitation in centimeters on the vertical axis, and then the horizontal axis is time again. And you can see there are some high points. Those high points are flood years, pretty significant flood years. And this record was a reconstruction by Mock back in 2006, and he was looking at written data, instrumental data. He had actual historical accounts of rainfall. So And this is what he sort of pulled together, was this history for San Francisco, Stockton, and Sacramento. These periodic droughts, but also periodic pretty severe flood years. And 1861-62 was a year that was remarkable for floods. It's probably the year that goes down in all the history books as the big floods in California. Biblical proportions, it rained for 43 days from December, late December to early February. And a lot of these rains were actually warm rains. So when we have warm rains falling in the mountains, not only is all that rain coming down as rain and not snow, but it's also melting some of the snow that's already there. So the result was the Central Valley was pretty much turned into an inland sea. It was completely underwater and flooded the city of Sacramento. It flooded all the way down to San Diego. The city itself of Sacramento, just as a snapshot, 10 feet of water. It was considered a frontier Venice. People had to get around in boats. Houses were swept away. People were floating. I mean, you've all seen pictures of floods. They're not very pleasant. The legislature had to move to San Francisco for 6 months. It took that long for all this water to go out the Golden Gate. And the state went bankrupt. So it's certainly not something we hope we'll be seeing again. And the causes of this kind of flood year, this kind of mega flood, are starting to be understood a little better, at least the mechanism. And this shot is taken a few miles above the earth, and it shows this what's now called an atmospheric river. You can see this white swirling pattern of clouds that bringing all this water vapor. So in case you haven't read the book already, just a very brief primer is California, we get most of our precipitation, essentially all our precipitation comes from the Pacific Ocean. Some comes from the Northern Pacific, but this particular kind of storm, these atmospheric rivers, they're coming from more of the tropical Pacific. And these stretch on for thousands of kilometers. They across the ocean, they're hundreds of kilometers wide. They carry water vapor from the tropics to where we are, which is the mid-latitudes. And it's the equivalent of up to 10 Mississippi rivers worth of water in these atmospheric rivers. So that's why they're called rivers. And what happens when this water vapor is transported to our home, California, when air masses that have lots of water in vapor form hit the surface, the land surface, and are forced to rise up and over mountains, like the coastal mountains and then the Sierra Nevada, the rain or the precipitation squeezed out. That water becomes, it condenses, it becomes rain. If you're at high elevations and it's cooler, it could come out as snow. But since we're talking about tropical systems, these mostly, again, are coming out as rain. They get squeezed out as they go up the mountain slopes and create that kind of flooding. And so the question is, how often does that happen? Boy, we don't want that to happen again, right? We're sure lucky we weren't around in 1861. Well, Lynn and I wanted to look at how common an event these kind of mega floods are. We've already talked a bit about how actually common mega droughts are, but let's look at how common floods are. And we have to look at different kinds of sediments for mega floods. A couple of examples are records that have been collected from the Santa Barbara Basin, so it's offshore. And another type are from floodplain sediments up in the Sacramento Valley. This shot shows you the a sediment core collected from the Santa Barbara Basin. And this is what Lynn and I call varve envy, or lamination envy. The Santa Barbara Basin is really nice because it's almost like tree rings. those, that stripy pattern, those are annual layers of mud that were laid down and preserved in the record. They don't get mixed up. There's no creatures living in the sediments in Santa Barbara Basin. It's too oxygen poor. So it makes a great depositional environment for our kind of research. And these laminations are really great. And what you can see is there are some unusually thick sediment layers that result from these mega floods. And we know that they're coming, they're terrestrial deposits. That's why they're a slightly lighter color than the darker sediments. But what that record shows, which is kind of a key thing to take home, is that the mega floods, even bigger than the one we saw in 1861, occur every 100 to 200 years. And it's been over 100 years. Just doing some quick math. So then I said we're also going to look at a few of the flood plain sediments up in the Sacramento Valley. This actually was a study done from an oxbow lake along the Sacramento River. And oxbow lakes form when the river does its normal meandering pattern and the meander gets cut off. And so you get this little curvy lake that's abandoned. And the only time it gets more water is if there's a flood year and the waters of the main river overtop and they go into that oxbow lake. And when they do that, they also carry a bunch of sediments with them. So we went to, this is a shot of us doing it. In fact, this record is from someone else's study at a similar oxbow lake, but this is just showing how you collect it. We went out there, it was really fun. You get on this little platform out in the water and it's sunny and nice and you collect these sediment cores. But this is what they look like. This was taken from Little Packer Lake, which is, again, an oxbow lake along the Sacramento. And it was research done by a couple of, again, Berkeley professors, Roger Byrne and Donald Sullivan, at that time was his graduate student. And what the record from Little Packer Lake showed, again, these sediment layers seem to occur every 100 to 200 years up in the Sacramento Valley. So that's something to think about. California has got a climate of extremes. What we've seen in the last 150 years is kind of a muted sample of what the state actually is more typical of having, which is more extreme events. And Lynn is going to talk about the future.
Right. So what does this past kind of tell us about future? We saw this earlier. So this is the last 10 years, and you know where we've been in these lower than average. You know, 10 of the 12 have been lower than average. And if we think back to the medieval mega drought, it was estimated that precipitation was about 60% average during that time, except that extended for over a century. And so, I mean, we've had this for about, the last decade or so. And we have had, you know, some wet years interspersed in there. It's thought that during the medieval time, there were very few of the wet years. And so what you saw during the medieval time was something more like just those red, you know, the lower than average that extended for a long period of time. And so I guess the question is, are we heading back into just a natural extended dry period? We don't know that. We've only had 12 years of this. And it's hard to really predict what's going to continue into the future. It's just that we do know that it has happened in the past. So that's a little concerning. And then on top of that, if you add the sort of complexity that we've added now is that the climate is warming and from greenhouse gases. We've had a 2 degree Fahrenheit increase since 1970, and that's projected to continue into the future. And we do know that in this part of the world, when you have warmer climate, you have drier climate generally because you have increased evaporation. And so in just from the warming itself, it will get somewhat drier just from increased evaporation. Some of the other impacts of that will be a drying of soils and of vegetation. We've already seen that there has been an increase in wildfires since 1980. A study by Daniel Kahan at Scripps Institute showed that the wildfire frequency has increased, and that's projected to increase into the future as well. And then the other thing that we've already been seeing is a trend toward average snowpack decrease, so the snowpack in the Sierra Nevada. And then this is actually a projection into the future. So we've already seen a decrease, but as it warms, more of that winter precipitation will fall as rain rather than snow. So you can see going into the late, like in 2070 to 2099, that the snowpack will continue to decrease, and so there will be less snow melt in the summer. So that's another area of concern. On the other end of the spectrum, though, some modeling has shown that with warming, you'll have more evaporation over the ocean and actually perhaps an increase in atmospheric river storms and perhaps larger storms is what the computer models are showing. So, in terms of preparing, we're going to have to be thinking about both sides of it, you know, planning for water scarcity, but also planning and preparing for these large floods. And remember, Frankie was saying that the Central Valley was under 20 feet of water during that 1861 flood. So that's something to consider, as that's an area that's the population is going up there. There's six million people there now, and that's, you know, those cities in the Central Valley are projected to keep increasing, as is the whole state, really. But, you know, is that a, you know, how safe is that to have populations in that area? And I think the other, in terms of warning systems, the U.S. Geological Survey is working on ways of informing people if, should such an event begin and they can see a trend in something like the 1861 flood of getting people out of there. You know, so just kind of with earthquake planning, it's just something that we need to think about and have people be aware of. As I just said, we need to start preparing for both a warmer and drier future, but also more intense events, flood events, as well as perhaps longer, more intense dry seasons. Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much. I'd like to remind our online and radio audiences that they're listening to the speech on the West Without Water at the Commonwealth Club in San Francisco. It's time for questions.
Thank you for the remarks. You've spoken mostly as to surface water. Does your research shed any light on groundwater and groundwater levels?
Unfortunately, you know, our research, in terms of past levels, we don't have data for that. No, we don't. I mean, clearly now the water table's decreasing, especially in the San Joaquin Valley, but it's likely that those waters weren't as severely affected because we're now actively pumping them out, and it could be that during the medieval time, that groundwater was actually a buffer or something that might have helped sustain populations to get through that drought, whereas we're depleting that water in the bank, so to speak, now with agriculture. So.
Do you have any comments on how dams can help in the future?
Well, I mean, the problem with dams, of course, is they have such tremendous environmental costs associated with them in the present and in the future. So, you know, I know that that is one of the, you know, solutions that people, you know, some people are looking to, but I think better spent time would be thinking of ways of conserving, reducing our water footprint, and trying to restore some of the natural flows to the systems we have. Because, I mean, they're impacted enough. You know, we got to think beyond just the human society impacts, but also we are living in a state with a lot of biodiversity that will really, that is impacted by our dams, and that'll only get worse.
Is there any prevailing theory as to why there's this cycle over these thousands of years?
Well, that's a good question. So the 200-year cycle I showed you is thought to be related to sunspot cycles. So there's a fairly robust sunspot cycle that shows up in a lot of different paleoclimate records. And so you know, that impacts the amount of solar radiation hitting the Earth. Well, if the longer ice ages are related to the changes in the Earth's orbit, so in relation to the sun. So we have the changes in the Earth's tilt and its orbit around the sun, the eccentricity and the obliquity that change over thousands of year time scale.
Do you have a sense of, I have two questions. Do you have a sense of how the variability of California precipitation compares to other long-term data around the country or around the world? And then the other is, do you have a sense of the extent of area as the processes you're seeing related to California, were they whole West Coast? Were they how far north, how far south did they go? How far east, and to what extent are they sort of whole continental processes or regional processes?
Okay. Let's see. The first one.
Variability.
Oh, right. Well, our current climate or weather in California is like the most variable in the country. We have the greatest variability, and I don't know going back in time. I mean, I'm guessing that it's. We're among the most variable here just because of the variability in the number of storms that we get per year is extreme. In terms of the extent of the events, like that medieval drought has been traced into the Southwest, you know, into the Four Corners region, and right. Oh, I thought you were talking drought. I mean, there were dry periods globally, actually, during the medieval warm period. So there's a book called The Great Warming by Brian Fagan, where the whole book is about, you know, going through all of these regions that were impacted. So,
as a practical matter, what the slide says we need to begin preparing now. Have you given any thought to how we can prepare for warmer, drier future?
I've thought a little about it. There's a lot of people actually doing a lot of research on that. For example, the Pacific Institute, which is I don't know if Peter Glick, who's in Oakland, has a water institute where they're doing a lot of research, and that's a great question. And I just noticed this publication they have, the Pacific Institute, showing that they actually, it was fascinating, showing that we could save, ways that we could save 14 million acre feet of water per year following some of these strategies. So the kinds of things they were looking at are agricultural efficiency, you know, various ways of smart irrigation and, you know, things like that. Let's see, stormwater capture is on here. water reuse, so water recycling wastewater, using gray water, recharging groundwater with recycled water, installing gray water systems into to water lawns and flush toilets. And then finally, urban efficiency, so replacing unneeded turf grasses with drought-tolerant plants and so on. So so there are some really excellent publications and studies that have been done. I think that it just seems like it never gets to that in terms of policy. It seems like we're not even monitoring groundwater now in the Central Valley or regulating it. It is unregulated. But I think they're talking about regulation this year in terms of groundwater, but obviously that would be an important step as well, because every other state regulates and monitors their groundwater. We're the only state that doesn't. Yeah, so this also shows that an interesting figure, 6 million, every year we use 6 million acre feet more water than we have. So we're getting in debt in terms of, and that's mainly because we're pumping so much groundwater.
Not to split hairs, but you have at least three different ways of getting at data. Do they correlate for rainfall and water flow and lake size and tree ring measurements, and et cetera?
Okay, so you mean our paleo data? Do
right.
they all correlate? Pretty well, because they've done modeling of the lakes, for example, to see how much reduced the input inflow to the lakes would be for them to shrink, and they came up with a figure around 60%. And the salinity, paleo salinity data from San Francisco Bay shows the salinity decreased by about 60%. So, or 40%. So we're seeing some agreement between our various studies.
I found your historical presentation fascinating because it seems like a lot of what is going on is part of a natural cycle over many, many years, with the huge exception of the 2 degree rise in temperature that we've experienced in about 40 years. And so if that could be dealt with, could you talk about how would it become better if we could control for less global warming?
Yeah, I guess maybe you could, I'm not quite sure specifically, are you asking what would happen in the future or?
Yeah, I mean,
mm-hmm.
If we can
bring that under control, I think, it's interesting because, really we were mainly interested in, when we did our research and continuing, in what is normal for California, what is the normal climate regime? Because really from 1850, which is when we start to have instrumental data recording, we were in a relatively benign period, even with that 1861 flood. And that's what our data show, and our data across the state, by and large, seem to agree that, we have this extreme pattern. Now, it's hard to say how much of what we're seeing now is a result of that natural cycle, and how much of it is because of this 2 degree rise. So that's kind of, we're dancing a little bit on the edge there because we don't want to say, if you take away, if we can reverse global warming, then the drought's going to end next year. We don't know. We don't know if we're in a 10-year drought at the end of it or if we're in the early stages of a 200-year drought. It would look a lot like the medieval droughts about 10 years into those. Would look fairly similar to what we've seen. So it is kind of hard to tease that out, and that's why when Lynn was saying, you add 2 degrees, this is what we know that 2 degrees can do. It can evaporate a lot more water off the surface during the summers. It can evaporate more water off the ocean, which is like fuel to the storms. So the storms we'll see will be warmer and more intense. So you take out the 2 degrees of warming, maybe we'll still have a drought, maybe we'll still have mega floods, but they won't maybe be as intense.
Has it been considered to have a system of aqueducts or canals throughout the nation in order to transport water from a flooded area to a drought area? It seems to me that it wouldn't be that difficult.
Yeah, and truckloads to Detroit from Canada. Well, unless you want to speak to it, I mean, really, we're paleoclimatologists, so, you know, we've had other audience, and perhaps there are people here who can speak to questions like water rights and, you know, water policy more directly. I think large aqueduct systems may play some role, but they're probably, again, not the ideal way to go. Certainly, we've seen the results of, you know, the California large aqueducts, you know, policies. So bringing across state borders, that's going to be tough. I mean, we've already got problems with taking the water from the Colorado River. Imagine who else is going to want to let us take their water so that L.A. can get bigger. But if there's money in it, they'll truck it, which will mean more gas, which will mean more greenhouse warming, right? Or, you know, so.
Yeah, I'm horrified by this thing that you pointed out, that we're 6 million acre feet using much more water than in fact we're receiving from nature. And this is kind of an unfair question, but is there a portion of your community that is willing to discuss the issue of whether there's enough of us, whether maybe population should be controlled, and that we ought to be dealing with this problem in a more sensible way than, I mean, having the data is wonderful, but in fact, the data suggests that we're not having much influence on this. It's going on anyway, and we're creating a problem.
Right, right. Yeah, I mean, it is a problem, right? I mean, we're at 38 million now, where it's expected to go up to, what is it, 50 or 60 million in a few decades. And, you know, obviously, more people is going to be more demand on water. Although, if we can start, you know, implementing and really, you know, a comprehensive plan like this, it might really, you know, I mean, it might really help some. But I think you're right. If you know, you can't just keep increasing the population on a limited amount of water. I don't think. But this is, you know, this is going a little beyond my field, probably. But
so we have time for one more question.
Your book has been out over a year now, right?
Yeah.
Have any policymakers of any kind, whether bureaucratic or elected officials, shown any interest in these kinds of findings?
I was contacted by Dianne Feinstein and I think Pelosi's, you know, just in terms of, you know, they had assistants who contacted me in terms of, you know, they were going to give a speech or they were going to do something. But I wouldn't say in a very serious way yet. So, I think it's hopefully something that they will start considering in the future.
So we have to solve the scarcity of interest before the scarcity of water.
Right, right.
Thank you very, very much.